What's up, everybody? Welcome to another episode of Game Dev Unchained, the number one game development podcast about game development and the lifestyle thereof. I am your host, Brandon Pham, and with me, two special guests, Damid and Marina. How are you guys doing?
Cool. Doing great. Thanks for having us.
All right. So this is the part of the podcast where I ask our guests, which is yourselves, about yourself, where you've been, where you're at, where you're heading. Just a little introduction to our viewers and listeners out there.
So, Damid, please go ahead first.
No worries. Yeah. So I'm Damid. I'm a co-founder of AllCorrect. Just founded this company with my friend 17 years ago. So basically, we're a service business. Helping other game developers and publishers to ship their games. They're awesome games. And also I'm an indie developer for the last 7 years on the side, making my own stuff. So that's about it, I guess.
Okay. So I'm Marina.
I live in Ireland with my three kids and a dog. And there you go, Marina.
That was important part to add. Thank you. So I'm Marina. I'm head of localization production at AllCorrect. With AllCorrect for 6.5 years now, and I've started as a project manager and slowly made my way to management. I love everything localization related, video games, languages, different cultures. So I enjoy every day of my work. And it's quite easy to do what you love. That's it.
All right.
I'm based in Serbia.
So there's a lot of question here. It sounds like your team is remote. Has it always been like that? Or do you guys have a unified office somewhere?
We have COVID to thank for that, I guess. So Damid was remote for many years. And if you want to share the story of you moving to Ireland, please go ahead.
I mean, we are remote and we are not. So it's a mixed bag, I would say. So we do have offices and, presence in different countries. So our production HQ is currently in Serbia, in Novi Sad, which is a beautiful place. I'm based in Ireland. One of my business partners is based in Toronto, Canada. Some other people in Spain, in other countries. So a lot of spread all over the globe, I would say. As we probably should. We're helping developers ship their games worldwide, right? So why not be spread around the globe?
Yeah. Your specific discipline, your guys' specific field is definitely a huge part of game development that doesn't really get discussed much, right? I think at least with internal teams, it's kind of like a big mystery, at least to me, working in these bigger teams, like AAA teams, I never really have any insight on that side, but it's actually pretty integral to kind of have a global scale recognition of your game in these different areas and different languages to kind of make it work. Can you kind of provide some background into this?
Absolutely. Yeah,
industry?
Absolutely. Yeah. I will start maybe high level, and then Marina will help me with the specifics. But generally, I think game localization is a thing that is very often overlooked, and it's something that you don't notice until it's really bad, or unless it's really bad, right? So it's the same with basically any sort of translation or interpretation. If it's there, you just think, oh, that's normal. That's I get this information, I process it, I hear it, I enjoy it, whatever. You don't really notice that it's there, right? So as soon as it get screwed up, that's when you notice it's missing. So I think that's one of the reasons why translations in general and game localization in particular is a bit overlooked. But also I think there's one thing that localization normally comes in at the end of the development cycle, right? Because you normally need maybe 80% of the text content locked in before you engage a localization team. And you know yourself very well, Brandon, that a lot of games, most games get delayed. Some games get delayed like 120-200% of the original, you know, allotted timeline and time budget. So by the time it gets to localization, the game is already late for shipment, right? Late for publishing. So everybody's rushing it up. And then the people kind of think, oh, you know, we also need this localized, you know. So it's a bit of an afterthought. It's not part of the core development process, at least in the producer's head, maybe heads, or I don't know, in project managers' heads, in heads of production, I don't know, game designers. It's still a mystery even to me. I don't know, but you know, it's hard to say. It's probably art and programming and game design are more visible from in pre-production stages. That's why, you know, localization is not. I don't know, Marina, do you have any thoughts on this? What do you think?
I only have to agree with all you said, because by the time we receive the text, most of the deadlines are already missed. And the only thought is we have to release as soon as possible. Please do whatever to increase our chances to release as soon as possible. Localization is a little bit more expensive than you think. And by the time the game is ready for release, the budgets sometimes, in many cases, are already a little bit tight. Localization is a difficult process, and it is a problem, especially with indie developers who release their games for the first time. People just don't think of localization in advance, and that's a pity, because it's very interesting, and if planned well, you have all the opportunities to release in different markets at once and save a little bit in marketing.
So basically we're in a tight corner as a service provider that provides localization service, because you know it's a crunch multiplied by a crunch is the biggest crunch you can imagine always, you know. So development teams may start easy and nice and relaxed, and then they start crunching before the release. But because we come late in the development cycle, we're always crunching because everybody wants stuff shipped fast and localization done very quick. And sometimes it's just not possible to deliver the best result, you know, so we do whatever we can. But sometimes I remember our first gaming project was Age of Conan Hyborian Adventures. And that was in 2008. And it had like about 900,000 words, which we needed localized from English into Russian. And man, we had like 3 months to do that or something like that. And there was no way the publisher was going to move this deadline. So we had, I think there were 11 translators and 3 or 4 editors working on this localization, and also proofreaders and project managers and stuff. And, you know, it's not the best practice, mm-hmm. to say the least, you know.
Is that a average team, if you describe a typical project where you're receiving a script in this case, right, and you have to translate it to a certain language, is it usually looking at 11 translators and 3 editors per language, or is it just every language that you have to translate?
Well,
how does it usually
depends
work?
Yeah, it really depends on the volume, depends on the deadlines, depends on the project, because for smaller projects, of course, the less people are involved in the process, the better the final quality is. But we have a process that allows us to manage the final quality even with a bigger team. So a typical mobile game with not a lot of words. For example, a mobile game with free-to-play model, which has like weekly events, so bi-weekly events, we will have like project manager working on the with the clients, with the developers. We will have one or two linguists working on this particular project, and that's it.
Language. And you mean per target language?
Yeah, I mean per one language. And of course, we do multi-language localization. So if the game requires several languages, it's several teams of linguists working at once.
Yeah, so I think I would add, it's not so much the number of people on the team producing the localization goes not into kind of horizontal scaling where you have a lot of translators working on the same title, but it's rather, you know, you have a terminology specialist working to analyze the original game and to create a glossary of all the terms in the game. And there is the translator who translates the content, and then there is the editor who edits it, and or a quality control specialist who does spot checks to see if there are any issues, and then there is a proofreader, and then maybe some other people, like maybe there is a subject matter expert, say if we're translating a game about history, right, with a lot of historical content, or a sports game or a racing game, there will be a lot of specialist terms that even the best translator wouldn't always get right 100% of the times. So we need also like to have a like subject matter experts on the team. So yeah, the number, even in the best case scenario, we will still have quite a bit of, you know, quite a big size team, but it's not because the content is split, you know, unless again the deadlines are tight, and then you know, we have to just think on our feet and do whatever we can to deliver the best result possible, which is, you know, sometimes just good enough, but yeah, we're doing whatever we can. It's generally, I think, a good idea to have no more than, say, three translators per one editor, because then when it goes above that, you need two editors to harmonize the text, you know, and the style and everything. And then who's going to harmonize the editor's text, right? Then you need, it's endless, you know. So
it's a pyramid.
Yeah, it's a kind of a Ponzi scheme even. So we would try to avoid those as much as possible. You know, so and then typically Marina mentioned, you know, mobile games. Well, mobile games are they usually have like 10 or languages or more, depending on the publisher, of course, but like middle-sized, bigger sized publishers have 10, 15 languages maybe. We usually not less than 7 or 8, you know, normally, unless it's an independent, like a small indie game. So they generally want us to deliver multi-language localizations simultaneously in all of those languages. And that's actually where our, I would say, DNA comes from. Because if you compare us to some bigger localization companies, service companies, even like public service companies working in the game space, they usually started as maybe local country distributors for games, right? So they distribute physical copies of games on floppy disks and CDs and stuff. And they had, and they usually specialized in one or two languages for their specific territories, say for Italy or for Germany or Spain. And then when the things got into digital distribution, and when it was easy to sim ship games globally, especially with mobile games, where you just check the boxes in your Google Play console or Apple Developer console, and boom, it goes live everywhere, you know. With these games, I think not all of the competitors could scale their competence to do all of these, you know. So some of them can, but it's hard because they can do their narrow thing very, very well. And they can also do like amazing voiceovers and amazing things like that, you know, and kudos to them. It's great. But we come from, say, multilingual first approach, I would say.
Mm-hmm. So do you guys cover mostly text-to-text translation, or do you guys provide dubbing or in-engine development? Like, how, what is the usual case scenario for you guys?
Maria?
Well, for us, we mostly do text translation just because there is more game content in the form of text. We do dubbing, but as Dimitri already mentioned, first of all, not all the games require dubbing. Not every game can afford voiceover, especially multilingual voiceover. We work with our partners, some studios in Ireland and Canada, to have like actors from all over the world dubbing the games in English and Spanish and so on. But that is like 3% of our games mm-hmm. that require voiceover.
Yeah, I mean, when you ask this question, Brandon, it's we all need to keep in mind, like, what's the biggest chunk of games there in the market now? Like, what's the biggest thing? What is it? It's mobile games, right? So mobile games are growing the fastest. They have the biggest chunk of the market. And you know, people playing mobile games, they don't usually have their headphones plugged in, so they play, you know, they play on silent and stuff. And a lot of them are also like casual games with not so much, you know, they're little and no cutscenes at all and things like that. So a lot of them are puzzle games, evergreen puzzle genres, like, you know, solitaires and stuff like that. Like, you wouldn't normally get dubbing there. That said, I would say even mobile games sometimes have voiceover. Like, for example, one of our you know, favorite customers is Northcurrent. They have these amazing hidden object games, right? Like Murder in the Alps and Murder by Choice, that have maybe like they're huge. They have maybe 100 million players or something. And they have English voiceover, which we record in Dublin. And you may be surprised, but players get really attached to the way it works in console and PC gaming. Actually, we were surprised to see that players of Murder in the Alps, they're in love with the character, with the voice actor doing the voice for these protagonists, right? So when Northcurrent switched to us for voiceover, we had to keep the voice actress, right, and the voice down. And that was really interesting. You know, that came as a surprise to me.
Mm-hmm. So just to kind of understand like a little bit more, you guys mentioned like the culturalization. Can you explain more about that aspect in game localization, how that affects, you know, instead of just text-to-text translation, there's, you know, sensitivity
sure.
issues yeah. that surrounds that as well?
I see Marina smiling. She probably has some good stories to tell. I have a couple as well, and I will chime in later.
Well, text-to-text requires culturalization as well, because every game has a rating. Every game has its content that could be considered a little bit offensive in this country, for example, drinking in German is not really well perceived for the games with lower age ratings. And it requires a lot of knowledge of what we can and what we cannot do in this particular market. So even the text localization requires a lot of thought about the culture. But what we do as well is culturalization analysis. It could be done at early stages of the development when we send the game build over to our specialists. They play a little bit and give their feedback about what could be considered offensive. For example, the mask in the game location should not be should be the tallest building and the other building should not be taller, for example, that. And we had a really funny case. We finished a culturalization analysis just before the COVID hit. And there was an antagonist in that game wearing a hazmat suit. And it was an antagonist and really, really bad guy in the game. And everything went great there. But when the COVID began and people wearing hazmat suits started to be considered heroes, like doctors and the essential workers. So we immediately wrote to the clients and said, well, let's reconsider that skin because it could be considered offensive nowadays. Like everything changed now. And they did. And the game was quite well perceived, actually. Yeah.
Yeah. I can chime in with a couple more examples what culturalization adds to the table. One example I remember when we were doing Valiant Hearts, localizing Valiant Hearts for Ubisoft into one of the languages, the Valiant Hearts is an adventure game about World War I, right? Which Ubisoft, one of our favorite clients, they were one of the few game companies actually globally who paid attention to the centenary anniversary of the First World War. And they made this amazing game about, a German character, a French character, and, there was a dog, and there were during the First World War, and there was romance, and there was, families were breaking up and people were dying. It was a very, very touching adventure game with simple mechanics, but very, very powerful characters and story. And we had history specialists, experts consulting us and working on the game. But also for the game, we expanded the encyclopedia. So the game comes with an encyclopedia of concepts and things that were meaningful 100 years ago, right? Which people don't even wear today. They don't even know what these things meant. So we expanded this encyclopedia and suggested some replacements in this encyclopedia, say for the Eastern European audiences to make more sense to them, because they, the uniform, what kind of uniform they wore was different from, say, French soldiers or from what German soldiers wore. So that's culturalization for you. And quite recently, I think we just finished, or we haven't even finished working on a project. I can't unfortunately name the client; it's under NDA. But we have been working on a historical game, a very famous franchise. So they're making a new title in the franchise, and the specific title, is developed by a Chinese developer. And the development team is great. It's amazing, but they have their own perspective of things, especially, and of, there is separatist, different historical perspective on things. But this, history themed video game is to be shipped globally. So we don't want people to get offended. We don't want players to get triggered. And, we also, this is kind of the reactive part. We don't want trouble for our clients, for the game companies, right? But we also want the games to be kind of better and more accessible and more fun, which is proactive side of culturalization, right? So we don't only look for red flags, like Koreans and Japanese have a thing about territory and about sea, and they have wars in their history and stuff. So it's important what you call these people who are these famous historical figures and generals and things like that. But also we want to celebrate in the game. We want to celebrate these famous historical figures and explorers. Make sure that they're not made fun of and that their achievements are highlighted in a nice way, which can be very tricky, especially when you come to representatives of smaller nations, say in the Pacific, things like that. So yeah, it was a tricky, very interesting project. We had like a whole, we have a narrative design team as well. So we had like our narrative lead and narrative designers working together with the localization team to adapt. And essentially we had to rewrite the whole text content in the game basically, because the original one was not really appropriate.
Yeah. For those who, I guess we go back to the beginning a bit, like I'm curious how, because this is a very interesting part of the industry. How did you guys get started in game localization? Like there wasn't really a clear path in my mind of how about I would go into this field,
right?
If I had to start right now. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. I can tell you a few bits about this because I'm co-founder. So my background was linguistics, and you know, philology and in the English language. So I worked for a bit in a English teaching school for adults for a while, and then my good friend Dennis actually he was nudging me a bit and saying, you know, what do you think of translation, you know, stuff? Why don't you translate things? And I'm like, oh man, listen, that's very different from teaching the English language, you know. So it requires different competences. I don't know anything about this market. But then he was very, very persistent, and he didn't have any you know, incentive in this. He was just my friend, and he was kind of showing me the opportunity. So in the end, I surrendered and I said, hey, Dennis, you know what? I'm starting this translation business and I want you in. Are you in? And he's like, oh, yeah, sure. So he jumped on board. He has got no relation to linguistics whatsoever. He's like a construction materials and production technology specialist, you know, very, very different world. So long story short, we started this translation company together. Then we had our first person employee on board. That was in 2016, 17 years ago. Then we started just translating stuff. It could be technical documentation, could be other stuff. But then already 2 years later, we localized Age of Conan. And then we just got very lucky because there were these MMORPGs from China and Korea getting very popular. You know, things like Perfect World and, you know, things like, I don't know, Ica Online and Jade Dynasty and these, you know, big games. They had huge word counts, but not many companies knew how to localize stuff using Chinese or Korean as the source language, because normally how localization companies work, they translate stuff from English into the target languages. So the source is usually English. Whereas in this case, the source was Chinese or Korean. And essentially, a lot of our competitors just didn't know how to do that. So we jumped at that opportunity. And sure as hell, we were messing things up half the time. You know, we had a lot of issues. You know, some clients weren't happy. Maybe a couple of clients left, unfortunately. But then we were learning very quickly. So we started doing, you know, localizing these MMORPGs, and then they started to decline, and then mobile games were on the rise, say maybe around 2010 or something. They started growing very exponentially, you know. And as I mentioned before, these companies were usually on the smaller side. They didn't have as many resources to manage localization very meticulously, and like hiring one vendor to do one language and hiring another to do Arabic and hiring one more to do French and whatever. So they usually wanted to have one local vendor to do all of the languages. And they also wanted them to be simultaneously shipped and with a good enough quality for all these players worldwide to be happy. So we saw that as an opportunity as well and jumped in, and we didn't know how to do that at first, and then we learned. Again, we tried to learn very quickly. So I would say, you know, that's how. And then we dropped everything else. Over all these years, then we dropped all the other things that we were doing, non-gaming related. So we focused on the gaming vertical. So we currently do only work with game companies, and we not only do translations, right? So we do narrative design, we do in-game art production, like 2D, 3D art, concept art, you know, those type of projects, some QA, but still localization, I think, is at our heart, I would say. So I think that's more or less the our story. And I got really lucky getting people on board on the team, like Marina here. Marina is our head of production for localization services. So I would say 2/3 of the company work under her, you know, leadership. Maybe half the company at least, you know. So and she's super professional, and there are many other people like her. So I'm super happy to be so lucky. So we have about 100 people now in the company, and they're all very, very super talented. I'm amazed how talented they are. Yeah.
What are the main languages? You guys mentioned before, like they said, you know, if they are looking for multi-language support, it was a number between 7 to 10. What languages are those exactly?
For Marina, I think. Yeah.
Well, the main tier is like basic European languages like French, German, Spanish, and Chinese, Korean, and Japanese. These are must languages for most of the games that are released in different countries, just because
Italian. Don't forget Italian. I mean, it's
Italian is decreasing now, unfortunately. Okay. I don't know why. It's a pity, because I'm currently in Italy, and it's a real pity. But yeah, Italian is like second tier language now. I hope I'm safe saying that here. But yeah, in the recent years, there were changes. For example, Spanish, European Spanish is a little bit replaced by generic Latin American Spanish, just because there are more players there. Turkish has been popular for the last 3 years. And now the South Asian languages like Indonesian, Thai are very popular, especially with mobile games, just because people play more mobile games there.
Yeah, it's interesting. Like people in these locations, players in these locations have never had access to, say, proper consoles like, you know, PlayStations and Nintendo, you know, whatever. So they didn't have nothing. They didn't have a PCs or whatever. And now they boom have these mobile phones and stuff. So they can play, and they do play on mobile phones, usually, you know, on Android phones, I think, because they're cheaper. So they're not as obviously not as lucrative as a market in terms of average revenue per user, but there is so many users and they're growing quickly. And then also, I think these territories getting richer and richer. So these are kind of their developing countries, but they're, you know, the dynamics are really good. So I think these is where the future lies, more or less. People used to talk about Africa as well, but I don't think it's on the table just yet. I'm pretty sure it will be at some point in the future, but so far it hasn't been too much of an influence, really. Yeah, funny, Marina, you mentioned this Italian, and it's totally in line with what I heard. I just flew back from GDC in San Francisco a few weeks ago, and I was meeting clients, old and new. And there was one client who said, like, oh yeah, we have for this huge game, we have like for European languages, they have like EFGS, which totally breaks the acronym EFIGS, which was ubiquitous, you know, all over the place. It was like, you know, EFIGS, English, French, Italian, German, Spanish. And E for Italian was the only vowel there. So that kind of made it a word, like EFIGS, you know. Oh, yeah, except for English as well. But, you know, it kind of was easy to pronounce. Now it's like EFGS. So shall I say FEGS or GIFs? I don't know. Like it screws things up big time. It's a pity.
Mm. Is it pretty common to see trends, some languages being... It sounds like it, that some languages over time gets more popular because of the growing gaming market there and then others decrease? Has it been sort of...
Decreasing, not so much, I would say. Would you agree, Marina? I think...
overall increase?
There's more demand of more rare languages now. For example, Polish. A couple of years ago, we analyzed the user sentiment on Apple Store and Google Play, and we can find all the language requests, and we analyze that, and there are trends there for sure, like Polish and Turkish were a trend 3 years ago. Now, don't know. Turkish is unfortunately decreasing a little bit.
What about Arabic, Marina? What do you think?
Well, Arabic is a little bit tricky, and we've hosted like a localization convention several years ago, and we had an expert of Arabic experts saying that the Arabic players are very happy when the game has Arabic, just very happy it exists. So it's very, very rewarding. And of course, there are a lot of players and a lot of potential money running there. But Arabic is very, very tricky to localize into. It's very tricky to adapt your gaming engine to process Arabic properly, just because it's right to left writing, and the writing is very tricky, and there are not a lot of fonts that could be processed. And if in the line there is, in the line of Arabic words, there is, for example, an English words, most of the game engines just go crazy and put everything back left to right. So it's very hard to, it's not very hard to localize into Arabic, but it's very hard to add Arabic in the game properly. So it requires additional steps of localization, quality assurance, several steps. And we had some bad luck with Arabic in the beginning, just because it's a very complicated language, and there is modern standard Arabic, which is like the written language, the language where the news in the Arabic countries are. But each country, like Egypt, Syria, and so on, have their own, not dialects, but their own language. Their own language. And if we are localizing a game which has a lot of contemporary lexics, like slang or memes, so on, it is very hard to make the game appealing to players from different countries. So we've created a separate process for Arabic when we have a translator from one country and editor from another country, just because we want to avoid those regionalisms. But it's still quite difficult to achieve the beneficial results that could work in every country. So Arabic could be quite rewarding, but it takes a lot of time, a long time to localize into and process.
I just wanted to chime in with the thing. Well, basically, localization is always a question of return on investment, right? So it's always a balance of, okay, this is how much we need to spend on localization engineering to make sure our game supports these fonts and these character sets and these whatever. The user interface is adaptable, and then we need to find and pay these, you know, localization vendors, or maybe hire an internal team, et cetera, et cetera. So these are the costs of it, and then there is the potential benefit you can get out of the market. So there's always a big unknown there, because nobody can predict with certainty how it's going to perform. It's just we've seen over the time that second tier languages were kind of getting stronger and kind of just staying there. So whereas earlier, say even like 15 years ago or 10 years ago, first tier languages were like, you know, a must have, and then second tier languages were like more rare. Now it's like second tier languages are almost like, you know, they're much more widespread, and then you have extra languages on top, which are kind of third tier languages or second tier languages, which are very often used as well. But seeing languages getting out of favor, out of fashion for localization is, I would say, is very rare. I don't remember any cases except for this Italian thing. But yeah, getting back to these languages selection, we do help to, Marina mentioned, we try to go kind of start from the bottom, from the player. I mean, I should probably have said from the top, from the player, you know. But anyway, I mean, the bottom of the market, basically, where we have these tools that automatically parse reviews on Google Play, on Apple Store, on the App Store, on Steam, some other stores to automatically select reviews that mention languages, mention localization, mention voiceover, things like that. And then we automatically translate them and we automatically mark them using algorithms, using machine learning to mark them as like positive sentiment about localization or negative, or requests for new languages. So then we can get that analytics together and then combine it with our experience of localizing other games in this genre. And then we can get back to the client and say, hey, you know, based on our experience working in your genre and also having analyzed players' feedback and player reviews, we can recommend you. And also we have, of course, store analytics, like we have paid subscriptions to like things like App Annie and or similar, so that we can also analyze how different games are performing in different territories. So we combine all of that and kind of give recommendations. So we don't, of course, kind of guarantee anything, but we can, you know, do a good job of just being reasonable and recommending things that are likely to succeed in different territories, you know, languages that are going to be profitable.
I have a question about, you know, the unique aspects of game development, how that intersects with the localization process. You know, how do you guys manage the localization process for games that have ongoing updates, expansions, especially for mobile games, right? They're constantly updating every month or two.
Yeah. Marina, I think it's for you.
We just deal with it. Well, it's not really hard, actually, because we have processes and we have good communication with the developers. It's crucial to have a person on the developer side who's responsible for that. And we can adjust our process or just request something additional to do our jobs better. But basically how it works is like we are sent the files for localization. It could be any format. It could be a script. It could be part of the code with the words written in it. Like any content that should be localized is sent over to us with additional materials like game assets, pictures, some context, what these buttons do. And at the beginning of the game, we have a huge project specs filled in just for us to understand better what are the expectations of the final results, what is the target audience, what is the main vibes we're going for. It's very long. It has over 70 questions, but it helps us to do the job better and to fit in the expectations. So, and with the weekly updates, it's not really a problem because we have all the specs already confirmed. We have the team of project managers and linguists. We work in a special special tools like computer assisted translation tools, and it helps us to keep consistency throughout the translations. Like Dimit mentioned, creating glossary already. Glossary is like a list of all the game specific terms like character names, locations, achievements, the currency. So every single time this word is mentioned in the text, it should be translated as it was before, so the players are not confused. So these computer assessment tools help us to check these things and just make our job a little bit easier and make us help us to guarantee the quality we usually guarantee. And that is basically how it works. And with the games with weekly updates, it's not like one pack of text sent over once a week. It's never like that. It's like 5,000 words on Monday, and next day here are 10 lines we forgot. And on Wednesday, here are like 20 lines we decided to edit. And here is the marketing line. Here is the push notifications we need to localize. And we also localize all of the marketing surrounding the events and the game release. So it's very intense sometimes, but it's part of our job. And it's like really how we live, and there's nothing wrong about it. Like project managers working with 15 linguists at once for one project, even if it's like 10 words, well, okay, no problem. We know how to do that.
Well, Marina, let's be okay. Frankly, it is a problem, right? I mean, we can tackle it, but it can be a pain in the ass, you know, like to be completely fair. But I mean, it's something, sometimes it's unavoidable, but you know, it doesn't mean that it's always fun and easy, right?
So tell the managers, please.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a cakewalk exactly, right? So for example, EA is one of our you know, old customers, and we sometimes do like 50 jobs a day for them. What's usually, I think we do about 50 jobs a day, and they can be as small as Marina said, like translate these 10 words, like a marketing phrase, into these languages, you know, or it can be as big as here's this new title, you know, content pack for this big title that we're doing. Like, for example, we do, you know, Apex into Korean, I think, and The Sims into Swedish, or if I'm not mistaken.
Used to do it for Norwegian.
Norwegian, yeah, sorry. Sorry if there are any Swedes around or Norwegians listening. I'm very sorry. Anyway, it's hard, you know, 50 jobs a day. And I mean, even there are small jobs, they need to be delivered on time or before, and with no quality issues. So that's tricky. And how we do it, I mean, there are several things that Marina mentioned, like, you know, translation environments, tools where translators work on the translation, and where you have the glossaries, where you have the translation memory that remembers the previous translations and stuff like that. But also, we try to be very proactive in terms of automation. And for example, we always will offer our clients to synchronize our content management systems. So even, for example, like with one of the big clients, it was a big pain. And we were at a point where we wanted to terminate working with client, actually, because it was so painful. There were so many jobs a day, and they needed to be manually imported. The text strings needed to be imported, exported, checked, you know, kicked around different tools and stuff. It was a nightmare. But then we just basically sat down with the client and said, hey, how about our localization engineers work with you guys to write an API that will synchronize the text strings from your engine and in our, you know, in the translation environment. And then it worked very quickly. And a month or two later, the client was profitable immediately, you know. And I think our project managers saved, you know, I don't know, at least 50% of their time now. They freed up their hands for the more important stuff. So that's one of the, you know, one example how you can really, you know, just do things quicker. And also there is this internal things going behind the scenes where we have project management tools and stuff, and actually very, you know, devoted, very professional project managers who will, you know, observe the deadlines. They would maybe wake up earlier, or, you know, we have shifts as well with project managers. So, you know, with some clients, I remember we had like one or two points in the day where when we were delivering content. So say if they send us jobs before 12 o'clock before midday, we will be able to deliver them a translation into 10 languages or so by the end of the day, the same day, if it's under, say, I think 1,000 words, if I remember correctly. So that's very tricky because you need to work with people in different time zones. Like, you know, for Japanese, you work with people living in Japan, and for Brazilian Portuguese, you work with Brazilians living in Brazil. And that's, you know, as far from Japan as you can get. So that's tricky, but, you know, if with the right planning, you can kind of manage it, I think.
With the, you guys were mentioning this before, you guys touched every piece of the market, you know, recently, you know, you guys are focusing a lot more on mobile, but are there any key differences with localizing a game between PC, console, and mobile platforms?
Oh, sure. Marina knows about it.
Well, timing is one of the biggest differences because, well, mobile games are constantly updating, constantly adding content, and everything is so much quicker there. And the teams are working in sprints, and all the almost every sprint ends in localization. Well, this is in terms of process, and the bigger publishers that publish games, bigger games regularly, and they learned about localization the hard way like 10 years ago, they now have more sophisticated planning and more schedules, and the process is a little bit smoother just because it's not us telling them, please, let's do that to increase the quality. It's like they say, we want to do that. We're just happy about it. So the process is a difference, and depending on the quality of localization process inside the developer team, just because in some companies, if it's their first game, for example, there is no one responsible for localizations, like that poor guy who was told, just send them over the files. And we are asking him 70 questions about, what do you want your localization to be? And that's a little bit tricky, and that requires a little bit adjusting our processes a little bit. The physical space for the text in mobile games is smaller for sure, and especially when we're localizing the games from Chinese, where two characters could mean the world, and we cannot just put a whole phrase in that space. So you maybe noticed that there are a lot of abbreviations in that kind of games, and it doesn't really look beautiful in most cases, but that's just because it was like three Chinese characters, and we have to keep the meaning as much as we can. Also, there are some complicated processes of compliance for console games, like for Nintendo Switch, for PlayStation, and there is a list of special terminology, like how the controller should be called controller, not gamepad, and so on. It's different for different consoles, and we have to check for that, just because in most cases nobody knows about it, and this will definitely fail the compliance process.
Yeah, it's one of these weird things that I'm pretty sure no player would care about or would even notice. Like, why care if this thing is called a console or a system? You know, like, who cares? But actually, you know, it's something that players, you know, don't really mind. But the first parties like Sony and Microsoft, they're really particular about these things. So, and I mean, translators, well, if when they maybe are just recently, they just recently started doing game localization, you know, they don't care. And like, for, you know, from common sense point of view, you'd say for a good reason, they don't care. They kind of focus on the important bits, on the conveying the emotions in the game, and, you know, making it interesting and fun. But the first parties do care. And I mean, if a system spills into a localization where it should be a console, you know, the game doesn't pass the quality check from the first party and the game gets delayed. And you don't want to get that, be at that, in that situation where your game is already late. So that's a lot of stress actually. And yeah, these compliance is also like Marina. It's both legal. It's also security. Like for big clients we work with, AAA clients, the security requirements are very, very high. Like there would be these, you know, USB sticks that are shipped around. So every part of the team, no matter where they work physically in Japan or Korea or whatever, they have these, you know, physical tokens that, you know, that have all the data is stored there, you know, something like that. So it's like, you know, things you would see in spy movies and stuff. Mm-hmm. So sometimes we have to go, you know, those lengths, of course, to satisfy our customers. And, you know, age risk compliance, right? There are more risks for AAA companies doing stuff for PC and console. So if there is any risk that the game may not pass the target age rating, then they would rather play it safe and, you know, reduce it. So in terms of localization, that means we need to be extra careful following the guidelines that Marina mentioned, like that those specifications that have 70 questions, questionnaires for our clients, you know. So they have these parts about, you know, what do we do with swearing, with swear words? What do we do with, you know, I don't know, sex references? What do we do with, you know, this historical references or whatever? I mean, if they're there in the original content. So these are important bits, I think. And we had to consult our clients sometimes as for, you know, LGBT themes, you know, for in certain territories, it's not desirable to highlight those topics. So we may unfortunately have to advise our clients to be more, you know, risk averse and recommend to tone things down a bit, unfortunately.
Yeah, and in terms of language, it's very tricky now because those inclusive language practices that could be easily adapted in English, in most languages, they just don't exist. And they are very controversial. And if the client wants the game to be inclusive in terms of language, like adding they or adding a feminine character, and in English, it's very, very easy. It's you. And you and all they, but in most languages that have gender as part of linguistics, it's very hard to achieve. And the newer inclusion language practices are not very really well perceived by the players, and it's all kinds of chaoses in several games. We've already had like. So in German, there are two principles that are controversial, that don't agree with each other, principles of inclusive languages, and the players were not very happy about that. There were like three groups of players. The two were not happy with each other, and the second was, and the third was not happy with inclusive language as it is. It was a nightmare.
I do have one last question as we are reaching that hour mark. What advice do you guys have for aspiring professionals who are looking to pursue a career in this field in game localization?
Localization is great. If you love languages, if you love other countries, other cultures, if you like to explore, localization is great, but keep in mind that it's less romantic than you could think. There are a lot of guidelines. There are a lot of like norms, and we're working just like factory producing the text, and it's a really underappreciated part of the game development. And so for some people, it's very difficult to cope with that.
Yeah, for aspiring people who want to get into game localization, my number one recommendation would be research what game localization is. You know, it's so easy now to have, you have access to all kinds of information, and you have ChatGPT version 4 on top now. So, which makes things even easier. I mean, don't trust it with everything, but yeah, just in case. Game localization is a peculiar thing, right? So there are things like limits to how long text strings can be. And there are these, you know, complications arising from different, you know, language genders that are exist or don't exist in different languages. And things like, basic things like German is longer than English, right? So, you know, you need to remember, you know, keep these things in mind. And in video game localization, you always work from the client's brief. You always work from the client's, requirements. So you need to be prepared for that, because sometimes we see very creative localizations that just don't fit the technical requirements bill, and that's unfortunate. And I think I imagine you can teach this, but it's still, you know, unfortunately, well, clients pay a lot of attention to those things, you know, and especially like first party terminology, like what, you know, will Microsoft red flag this and the game will get delayed? This is very important. I would say research what game localization is, and then when you apply for, say, TAS job, when you apply for like job placement and internships and stuff, keep that in mind. Ask questions, be more proactive. Like, don't take things for granted. Always, if you don't understand something, double check, ask a question, jump on another call, you know, things like that. Add notes to why you have translated it this way or the other, you know, be kind of braver. That's very important.
All right. Well, I want to thank on behalf of the listeners and viewers out there for you both coming on. This is the part of the podcast where I shut up, hand the mic over to you guys to give attention to let the people know out there how to find you guys on social media and so on and so forth. Take it away.
Right. You know, I would probably use this in the first place to be useful to our potential clients, to game developers, because I think the majority of your audience are game developers, right? Mm-hmm. Indie developers, you know, team members of big companies and stuff. So I would definitely recommend paying attention to localization engineering early on when you start working in your game. Like do simple stuff like do mock translations, you know, early in the game where you just started production, you know, translate this automatically with Google Translate or whatever, and then just see how the stuff looks in other languages that you think may be important in your game, right? To see that that it's technically supported, right? Think about how you store your text strings, you know, don't have them embedded in the code, have them, you know, have a good architecture to store those text strings, because these things will be very, very difficult and painful to fix at the end. You know, if you can, maybe don't use super specific, super customized fonts, because otherwise, you know, what if you decide to add, you know, Cyrillic supporting languages or things like that, you know, and your language only supports Western European character sets, you know, characters. So then what do we replace this beautiful font with something that looks out of place, or do you spend extra money on somebody to develop the, you know, a similar font for Cyrillic characters, you know? So or things like, you know, thinking proactively even about the territories you want to go into, because, you know, sometimes we see people just think they focus on one or two territories, but they haven't done research in their game genre, and they would be surprised to learn that, oh, you know, this genre is popular in Korea or it's popular in Brazil, you know, so that might change your project schedule and project budget as well. So have the money budgeted for localization early on. And you think about localization testing as well. Who's going to do that? Do you have the resources to do it yourself? ideally, you don't want to have it done by, you know, just your friends and college teachers of a certain language or something. That's not a good practice. So you probably want to have it done professionally. But then, you know, you need to figure out how you're going to check quality, because one of the biggest challenges we have, it's good we're talking about this now, because I think the biggest challenge I face as a founding partner of a service provider is not only for localization, but for other services too, but localization specifically, especially, there is such a big focus on price. And I'm not saying price is not important. Of course it is important. You only have so much money to spend, right? But it can't be the only thing, you know? It's very often it's like, oh, we should go with the cheapest or something like that. It's horrible, because even I'm as an independent developer, one of the games I made in a startup, we had a European publisher, and the publisher wanted the game I was making to be localized in 4 languages. And I said, hey, I have this localization team. They're really good. They know what they're doing. And the publisher said, no. We've got our own guys. We'll go with them. And then I said, look, but let us at least do the localization testing bit. And he said, okay, you can have the localization testing. So that was good. But it turned out that the German was so bad, we had to retranslate it from scratch. Italian, French, and Spanish were very bad and needed to be edited, all of it. And the publisher then had to pay us to do the edits. So in the end, the publisher paid probably around 50% more than originally budgeted, right? And instead, they could have just paid 10% more for us to do the job and not have it redone, you know? So the general advice is be smart about it. Think, what are the actual important bits for you? If quality matters for a game, which not is always the case, I mean, what is quality for you? You know, do you want the game to be fun? Do you want to, like, what things are important? Maybe the technical things are more important, or it can be very different, but for different games. But have a process in place to test your vendors before you choose them. Don't ever, like, rely on just references, marketing pitches and stuff like that. This is not a good, you know, way. Like, the only way is to have a proper test job, and maybe even don't tell people it's a test job. Just send them a bunch of files to localize and give them a tight deadline and see how they you know, fare with that, and then have a process to assess the quality of that, and then assess other things like how fast it was, how good the service was, how quick the guys replied, did they recommend stuff. Like, did they recommend things to be changed and adapted for different territories and stuff, you know? So this is the important bits, you know, were they proactive? Were they nice to deal with? So I think this is the most important bit. Like, you can definitely, we're called All Correct. You can find us pretty much anywhere on the web. We have an Instagram. We have all kinds of, you know, social media presence and everything. I won't go into too much detail there. You can even really search it all, but I mean, basically All Correct is one word, or even two words. All Correct Group is the name of the group of companies, and we do all of these services that help you ship the game and players have fun with it.
Yeah, I just want to add that we were nominated for Mobile Games Awards, and Dennis asked us to pitch that. And
oh yeah,
ask...
we actually were. Yeah. We're looking forward to the actual you know, award ceremony. So we don't know if we make it to first place or second place or something, but it's already cool that we're in the shortlist of, you know, nominations for that award, which is pretty awesome. And I mean, it's all because of the team. And you can go, and I really love when clients credit the team. So if I go on Mobi Games and I type All Correct, I say, oh, you know, we're in Jedi Fallen Orders, you know, credits, and oh, we're in this, you know, Trials game, and there's this Crew game, and there's, you know, Anthem and stuff. And I'm like, yo, and it's not like All Correct and Dimitation is not even like there, you know, there's like Marina there, or maybe not even Marina. There will be like project managers there and translators and editors and testers and, you know, the subject matter experts. And these are the guys who deserve it. You know, they're really, I'm really proud of them, and they're really proud of their job. And it's great when they, when I see them credited there, it's so rewarding.
Yeah, definitely. I think in all aspects of game development, more recognition is just going to help. Yeah, it's just one of those things that audio overall is always like the last team to touch anything. And then localization is like a part of that.
It's like the end of the credits.
Yeah. So I definitely empathize with the type of timetables that you guys get at the end of game development. It's pretty stressful and admirable.
I think giving clients are getting better in this. Clients, I think there is a trend. I think so. Yeah, I think like guys like Ubisoft and EA are getting better at crediting like their localization teams on their on mobile game, like in their games. It's not the case really with mobile games, which is the biggest. We need to remember it's the biggest market now, but there is no place for credits usually, unless it's an indie game or like a narrative heavy game. You wouldn't normally have credits at all, which is a pity. And I think it must be changed, because all of the designers need to be credited, everybody, programmers and artists and all of these amazing people. Mm-hmm.
It's true. Yeah, I wouldn't even know where to find the credits on mobile games. There's no end credit scene. Yeah, you're right. Well, I want to thank you guys for coming on. Hopefully that hour is painless. I've definitely learned a lot. It was a topic that I was very interested in. Being in the industry for so long. Yeah, it's amazing to still find holes or gaps in my knowledge about the game industry or different departments and disciplines.
Never learn. Thanks.
Yeah, I want to thank you both for coming on and sharing that knowledge. As always, all the description and links will be provided in each episode summary, so you can find all correct and information on Demet and Marina if you want to get in touch with them. Other than that, that's it. I'll see you guys all next week.
Thanks. Have fun making games.